All right. Well, good afternoon, everybody. As always, you're listening to the ASSP Healthcare Practice Specialties Healthy Podcast. We appreciate you joining us. I'm Corey Worden. I'm the current administrator for the ASSP Healthcare Practice Specialty. And today's episode is going to be really good. Today we're talking about a topic that's relevant to literally everybody. And we've got some fantastic guests from the Black Skin Safety Excellence Common Interest Group, or BICE. So another good point of interest, today's podcast is a joint publication between the ASSP Healthcare Practice Specialty and also the AOHP, the Association for Occupational Health Professionals in Healthcare. So we're going to be talking about a important subject, and we've got some great people to talk about it with. So to get into it, today we got, clear my throat. Today we got Emmanuel and Stephanie. They're from the Black Skin Safety Excellence Common Interest Group with ASSP. So short of me speaking for them, I'm going to ask them to give a quick intro. Stephanie, let's start with you. If you want to give a quick intro yourself, where you come from, what you're doing, anything you want to add, we appreciate it.
Sure. Well, hello. I am Stephanie Johnson, and I currently serve in an EHS manager role with responsibilities for waste management with my company. I have actually, throughout my career, had various EHS positions where I've served as the EHS lead manager with full responsibility for environmental health and safety. And I've actually served in companies where I've been specifically the safety manager or the EHS manager. And so with both of those, you know, just gaining a lot of understanding and knowledge and actually collaboration across the EHS ecosystem in order to ensure the company met the compliance requirements. I have been a longtime member of ASSP, serving at the chapter level in all of the officer roles, including president, and I've served for Region 3 as the area director, as well as an assistant RVP, and right now I'm happily serving on the BICE Advisory Council. I'm an alumni of the University of Texas at Austin. Yes, that means I have some really great years and some really bad years, and I just hope this year is going to be a good year. So that's a lot. That's about me. And I look forward to the discussion today. Thank you for the invite.
Well,
Emmanuel, go ahead, please.
I was going to introduce myself as well. So I'm Emmanuel Winfield, and currently also serving as the health and safety manager at our university in Auburn, Alabama. And in my past previous roles, I've had also served as the occupational safety manager for another similar university in Statesboro, Georgia Southern University. In some of my other roles have mostly been with the state. So I was also an environmental specialist working for the state of Florida, and kind of mostly managing the mining and mitigation sector in South Florida. Other previous roles has been with working as a health and safety specialist in the oil and gas sector, and then also in the mining sector as well. My educational background is also mostly in biochemistry and environmental science, but currently kind of diverged a little bit. I'm doing my PhD in industrial and systems engineering with focus on occupational safety and health and ergonomics as well. And then I'm serving currently as the executive secretary on the BICE committee.
All right, that's outstanding. Yeah, definitely. Just a fantastic level of professionalism. So we appreciate y'all being here. That's great. All right. So like we said, today we're going to be talking about ergonomics, which is a topic that is always relevant to everybody. It ranges from workstations and computers all the way up to industrial applications and hospitals and pharmacies and labs and everything in between. So it's one of those things where as a group of safety professionals, you know, we're always in pursuit of best practices on how to address ergonomics, preferably in a proactive way. So we're going to get into that today. So first things first, you know, before, as we do with any hazard analysis, you know, we identify the hazard and then we look for where that hazard shows up and what forms it takes and how it manifests. So let's go ahead and get into that. Stephanie, let's start with you on this one. What have you seen in your career as far as how ergonomic hazards show up and how ergonomic injuries have happened? What are your thoughts?
So quite across the board, I've worked in different settings, and so I've observed it from different applications and a job where right now I'm working in telecommunication industry, and so we have both the administrative roles as well as the field technician roles. And out in the field, you know, we're seeing those types of ergo hazards that come from, you know, the lifting, pushing, noise, anything in the field that could, you know, cause those MSDs. And then, of course, administrative-wise, it's the ones that we always hear about, the carpal tunnel, eye strain, posture resulting in back. And then also in the field, you know, we've had rotator cuff injuries resulting from how our employees are pulling ladders down.
Yeah, that's a unique one. I've seen situations with ladders, but I haven't seen that one. That's interesting, but that's good that y'all were able to identify that and work on it. Emmanuel, what do you think? When have you seen ergonomics hazards manifest?
Yeah, so currently in the higher education sector, not so much of the typical ergonomic hazards like lower back injuries and carpal tunnel, but in my previous job role in different industries, some of the issues were mostly kind of came from manual material handling activity, so some repetitive activities and also some vibration causing some individuals to develop trigger fingers. And then also a lot of the time, mostly from the vibration, the blanching on the fingers as well. So those are some of the issues that I have experienced in the past, but right now mostly lower back injuries were from office setups, how different people have their workstations set up in labs as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, those workstations, they're interesting. You know, as safety professionals, whenever I speak with people that aren't in the safety field, in a lot of time, a lot of conversations, people will think that if you work in an office or an administrative area or whatnot, that there's no potential for any kind of injuries. And very rarely do people think about the workstations and the repetitive motions and the musculoskeletal disorders and awkward positions and all those things. But that's certainly a major factor to both of y'all's points. And then, of course, you had the more acutely hazardous things such as ladders and lifting strains, things of that nature. So definitely a lot to think about. All right. So if we know how those hazards tend to show up, then of course the next question is, what do we do about it? So first things first, with any of these hazard controls, you know, what are y'all's thoughts about regulations and standards around ergonomics? You know, ergonomics is historically notorious for not having a regulation, even though it's always cited in our general duty clause. What are y'all's thoughts about that as far as guidelines, regulations, and standards? Do you think it's effective, or do you think there's still work to do? Emmanuel, let's start with you this time. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there is still a lot of work to do in that area, because the economics is more of it's kind of personal. Each and every individual has different variabilities and characteristics that, you know, the way you may set up a workstation may not be still beneficial to the next coworker or the next employee. And so I think the area of economics needs to be looked at from an individual standpoint. I think, you know, the different evaluation tools, each of them have their own advantages and disadvantages, and not every economic assessment tool can work for every type of job. But then I think the more it needs more research to kind of help identify ways to make sure that you know, certain kind of assessment tools can be tailored for some non-routine type of activities that may not fall, the normal, like the NIOSH guideline or the NIOSH lifting calculations, because some of them, some tasks may not, really fall within that aspect as well. Yeah, I think there's more work to be done in looking at it for more personalizing some of the assessment to make sure that people can be able to look at how those characteristics can benefit them when assessments are being done.
Yeah, and I'll just add to that, you know, it really makes it hard because it's left up to the company to decide what program they deem necessary for them to measure and reduce ergonomic hazards. And so without having that rule and really just having the general duty clause, and the alerts are good too that they issue every now and then, but to really have a rule that you can go back on brings a little bit more consistency, because I've seen in different companies how each one of them will implement the ergonomic program, and it's a wide ranging. And so you usually see a result from that wide ranging type of program in how they're experiencing certain ergonomic hazards and issues with their employees.
Yeah, and I'm gonna add on to Stephanie's comment. I think some standard will be ideal to kind of give some kind of range as to, how things can be done, and then, supporting it more with easy to apply and easy to understand assessment tools, because a lot of times some of these assessment tools, it gives you like a number and it's hard to really kind of relate what that number is to a particular employee. Say, for instance, you're dealing with someone 21 years old versus 61 years old. How do you determine what their lifting capacity is going to be? And also, how, if you make an assessment, what is the effect from a physiological standpoint to both two employees? So I think the standard will kind of help to ensure that employees are actually taking those into account, but then also supporting that with some easy to understand assessment or guidelines.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
That's great input, definitely. Yeah, it's interesting the way that this has all unfolded over the years. You know, there's been these kind of push and pull, start and stop processes with these regulations around ergonomics, and it, regulation or not, it remains very important part of the role for a safety professional and a industrial hygienist every workplace. So that kind of puts us into the next thing, which is, without any hardcore regulations, then it leaves it open to organizational risk assessment in a way where they can, they can decide how much emphasis they want to put on it. And so that kind of puts it into the realm of the hierarchy of controls, where, in some cases, some of these things can be completely eliminated if it's possible. And otherwise, we can go into substitution and engineering and administrative controls and see what we can do. So there's a lot of options. If you look at just a cursory overview of a of an office supply catalog, you can find an awful lot of ergonomic equipment, and some of it more effective than others, depending on the person and the situation. So I'm interested about y'all's thoughts on how to apply the hierarchy. So let's start with the first two, with elimination and substitution for ergonomics. Stephanie, let's start with you this time. What are your thoughts about eliminating or substituting ergonomic hazards?
So I do think it's a really good start. You know, one of the things that I think back to, and kind of I mentioned about the rotator cuff injuries that, you know, were observed, you know, initially we had a ladder on top of a truck and the employees had to go and pull that ladder down. So after years and years and years of, you know, having your arms over your head and lifting something off, it eventually had an impact on them. So the reactive, reacted to that for future elimination of hazards, and then through, you know, having the prevention through design by implementing something on the truck that would lower the ladder down for them, and they would just have to pick it up from, you know, the waist level. So that was kind of a result of the issue in the injury. By not really having a good risk assessment at the front end to make that determination, we pretty much defaulted to the reaction and implementing something that is now in place, and it does prevent that hazard from happening as an ongoing issue with those particular drivers that use that particular truck. So, you know, I see that as one of them is more, you know, the risk assessment as an ongoing part of your ergonomic program, and talking to employees and finding out, you know, where are the pinch points, as opposed to waiting for the injuries to happen. Because, you know, we're still experiencing the cost, and now there's going to be the additional cost of implementing those new preventions through that new design. Was there another part of your question?
That's great. Yeah, we were just starting through the hierarchy with the possibilities for eliminating ergo hazards. Like you said, you know, with changing design and working on removing the hazards completely, or substituting, you know, changing things around. That was great. Great input. Emmanuel, what do you think?
Yeah, I think being on the front end. So in one of my past roles, one of the things I did was to work with her mostly during building design determining layout of certain workstations. I was more involved in the architectural design phase, and being able to also work with interior designers to kind of look at how different certain layouts were going to be made, and how, you know, certain purchases of certain different tables or certain devices were thinking how they should consider the ergonomic aspect of that, and in fact that into the design stages. So we were able to an example was more on with our custodial group, where they had to do a lot of you know, the cleaning, and so especially a lot of the time where they kind of do their mixing stations, typically it will require them to be able to lift things. And so we had it set up where the architects were able to introduce some kind of lifting devices in there. And so rather than then being able to just go in there and try to lift things out, the areas that they will have to gather their materials has some lifting devices in there to allow them to not actually overexert themselves. So being if that there is a possibility as a safety professional to get involved in the decision, you know, the buying decisions of certain things, you can make a lot of impact to help make sure that those things are economically safe. And if there are certain hazards that is associated with them, you can eliminate them as well.
That's great. Definitely a lot of good input. All right. So yeah, in some cases, you know, like y'all said, there's a lot of costs, you know, a lot of overhead and sometimes even, you know, needs for capital funds to get into redesigning things and trying to eliminate ergonomic hazards. But in a lot of cases, we can go into certain pieces of equipment. You know, we can adjust, we can get adjustable chairs, and we can get things like monitor risers, and we can get document holders and things of that nature for workstations. Or in other cases, you know, there's all different kinds of equipment for industrial applications. What type of equipment have y'all seen in the past where you've been able to engineer out some of those hazards, or I should say mitigate through engineering? Stephanie, what do you think?
So in a past company, we actually did ergo evaluations on every new employee that came in. And it was predominantly administrative, or if they worked in a certain area, there was still an ergo evaluation. And part of that evaluation was setting up that workstation with that person and giving them the tips and showing them how this equipment worked for them, how their chair worked, and how the, you know, the height of their screen worked. And so, you know, that company had very little ergo findings or ergo injuries because it was addressed at the very front end and the equipment was provided at the front end. Each ergo evaluation was followed up with a report to the manager and the employee if there were recommendations for additional purchases that were needed. And if the person, you know, had that information, they were able to work with their manager to secure the equipment they needed and were able to utilize the equipment properly so that the ergo issues did not crop up. And if they did, they were able to have a direct line to the ergo specialist and have them come back and do a reassessment if things changed, or if their office, so if they got a new office, they got a new ergo assessment, or they had the old ergo assessment implemented in their new office. And so it followed them around throughout their career. And I always thought that that was probably one of the best practices I've seen in how you make sure the equipment is there at the beginning. And also the understanding of ergonomics is at the onset of the employee start with the company.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I like how y'all incorporated that into your onboarding process. That's really good. That way you can make sure that people have the, you know, the proactive ergonomic adjustments before, you know, they get into their work, and after, you know, 4 months passes and they start to realize there's either awkward positions or discomfort or whatnot. And that's really good. Emmanuel, what do you think? Have y'all had any experiences with using different equipment or engineering solutions?
Yeah, so in the previous example that I was giving, where our cleaning services crew were getting a lot of the lower back injuries. So one of the things we looked into when we got involved, when I got involved with the architects and the interior designers, were, you know, all of our new buildings, the way the trash bins that were being purchased were the ones that had a step, so you can actually, you know, step on, and it elevates the load, so you can actually lift it at elbow height rather than having to reach in and pull out the load. So over time, when we started doing that, we noticed that the rate at which lower back injuries were being reported had decreased. And so the cleaning services manager actually liked that the rates were going down, and employees were also saying that they've seen a lot of improvements in their work performance. And so I worked with the manager at the time to start looking into changing out the old ones that were in the existing buildings to make sure that it can be all throughout campus. And that really helped to reduce the lower back injury among the cleaning services crew as well.
That's great. Yeah, I recall some experiences with with situations similar to that. And when I was in hospitals back in the 2010s, there were, you know, there are situations where they gather all of the linens from throughout the hospital into a cart, and then they take the cart out, and then that gets offloaded into, you know, another transport for it to get taken to the laundry. So aside from the fact to make sure that everybody's safe from exposures to any potential hazards that are on the linens, you know, being that they're in a hospital, maybe bloodborne pathogens or body fluids or whatnot, but then the fact that you have this cart, which is very deep and very, very heavy, and you have a lot of linens that the weight accumulates very quickly. So just something as simple as wheeling that cart down a ramp to get it out on the loading dock has the potential for a strain, just doing that. So there's a lot of factors. So that's cool that y'all were able to break that down and figure out solutions. That's awesome. All right. So the next thing on there, you know, if we go to the point where we're not able to do ergonomic adjustments, then in some cases we can do administrative controls where we can change processes, or we can put limits in place to prevent overexposure. Have you all ever had any experiences with the administrative controls? Manuel, let's start with you this time. Any thoughts on admin controls?
Yeah, so training is really important here. And then also as a safety professional, being on the forefront and doing that risk assessment and identifying those hazards early on, and being able to you know, break it down to the employee, and then also management, really helps so that they can make some adjustments, especially our in one of our areas, we had employees that were doing more manual material handling and removing equipments and furnitures out of certain places. If an employee leaves a place and they want to change out, and so they were doing a lot more heavy lifting. And so we had to kind of, we did implement some changes, but following that, one of the things that I have noticed is a lot of the time having an ergonomic tool does not make someone work ergonomically safe. And so you have to be able to train that individual to understand why they are using those particular tools and its benefit to them, because if they've done it manually, they think you're slowing them down. One of the examples is the palletizer, because that is there to help you to be able to shrink wrap or palletize, and so but then employees would prefer to actually do it you know, by themselves without using the devices that we purchased. So we had to just take our time to train them, to help them understand you know, the risk factors in there, the repetitions that were involved, and how this, even if they were doing the number of cycles where they were, you know, repeating that activity, and its impacts on the employee. And so when we started kind of helping them to understand the impacts and what it can result, they finally were able to understand it and started to actually use it. And over time, they adjusted to the new system that we implemented. So I think training, and also just get breaking things down as to why those new devices is available, and allowing them to also know, you know, the benefits to them, I think helps.
Yeah, that's awesome. Definitely, definitely important stuff. Stephanie, what are your thoughts as far as admin controls?
So some of the admin controls that I've used or used with different roles that I've been in was one of the main ones we found out was, you know, really good preventive maintenance on our tools. Because if our tools were working at the optimum, then they'd have less effect on our employees, you know, the less of the vibrations that cause some of the ergonomic hazards in that particular arena. Also managing, just a basic managing, ensuring that people are taking breaks. In some of the manufacturing roles, we would have people you know, rotating between two different types of activities during that day so that they were not, you know, just standing in one place or working in one way throughout the day. And just really establishing, you know, those systems where people know what they should and should not be doing, making sure that if it's a heavy load or something, we have those requirements in place and we have those policies in place on how those are supposed to be handled. Making sure that if it's something that needs two people, that that's always the default for employees and that nobody thinks that they have to move it on their own because everybody understands that this is an item that requires two people and the help is there and offered.
Some of the other, you know, controls that we have with data implement as well was especially on some of our employees that were doing more repetition activities was looking at ways and introducing devices that would help to minimize the number of repetitions that would be taking place. And then also with some of our paint crews, looking at trying to get them more, if they were doing more spraying activities, we try to get them more telescopic handles where they could adjust it to make sure that the wrist was staying in more neutral position during some of those activities. And we also try to find, there isn't a lot of those tools out there, but we were able to kind of do a lot of research. We were able to get them some tools that has some grip to it. And so it minimizes the amount of grip force that they had to apply if they had to do some kind of activities. And some of our guys that worked in the manual material handling, limiting and minimizing those, the amount of grip forces that were needed to lift certain equipments or certain containers.
Yeah, and I had a crew that did preventive maintenance, and one of the administrative requirements we had is that you had to have a minimum number of people on every crew that was doing that work, because what that allowed is, if it, especially if it was overhead, that person didn't have to stand up there very long if we knew it was going to take, you know, more than a few hours to get the job done. Or if you had somebody there that was able to, you know, make sure the tools were passed up, the person didn't have to bend down or to reach down to get something. It was an easier way to make sure that tools were passed between people from where they were and where they were needed.
That's fantastic. Yeah, it's always interesting with the administrative controls is that there tends to be a need for them. You know, like y'all were just discussing, you know, things like having assistance for a lift or being able to work something between multiple people so that it's not just one person trying to handle it. We see that a lot in healthcare with patient mobility, where if we're doing a patient transfer, you know, getting somebody from a hospital bed into a wheelchair or vice versa, or any number of these different situations like that, you know, the idea would be that you have the equipment to where it's able to completely minimize the amount of force and weight that's required for the individual to help with. But in a lot of cases, either that's not feasible, or even with the equipment, it still isn't as safe as it can be for the one person to do it. So having that assistance there is critically important. And in a lot of cases, organizations will have a lift team for that purpose so they can have the proper assistance as well as coaching. So that's great feedback and certainly applicable across the different industries. So the last part of the hierarchy is interesting to me, because there's kind of there's research about.
Corey, I think you went out.
And it's also a point of contention for some people. So with PPE, in some cases, I'm sorry, go ahead.
You went out.
I thought I was hearing something. I'm sorry, say again.
Your audio went out, so I don't think we heard the entire spiel.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Okay, yeah, I was just saying that in PPE, there's always been the presence of back belts, you know, the back support belts. I know I see them often, people working in hardware stores or big box stores. And there's, you know, there's research that shows that the intention of those belts is to provide abdominal compression and prevent those kind of strains. But there's also research that shows that it simply provides a false sense of security, and then people try to lift things that are unsafe and it ends up with an injury. So it's kind of a interesting situation over the years with those. What are y'all's thoughts about those back belts? Stephanie, let's start with you. What do you think?
I think back belts without proper training on how to lift are probably not as good as they can be. Because like you said, you know, it can give you a false sense, and you still have to use good lifting practices in order to avoid the back injuries that we normally see out there with people that are having to do the lifting and squatting and, you know, anything that requires them to utilize their legs and instead of their back and doing their job. And so, you know, we still have to have a good training program, a good safety review program that talks about proper lifting.
Yeah, and I totally agree with Stephanie. You know, providing those devices, the back belts, without really having some kind of controls in place in determining, you know, the maximum lifting loads that, you know, an individual should be able to lift, and also how far that individual needs to, you know, reach for certain items. That's provide, you know, if without those trainings, just providing the back belts will give that individual a false sense of protection, and they may do things that can even hurt them more than without the back belt. So I think complementing that with training, and then also putting in place some guidelines based on, you know, risk assessment in terms of the maximum lifting load or how far an individual needs to reach to grab items or lift from, because those all can actually affect the load that an individual is lifting. So definitely training should be incorporated into it as well.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Great input. All right. Well, cool. So the next thing we'll talk about is we got those controls in place. And then the question is, how do we validate that to see if the controls are working? You know, if we're on the right track, if the controls are being used, and if they're preventing. Just so you know, I'm getting a weird light on my phone. So in case it drops, if you want to hang on for just a minute, I'll be right back on a different phone, but hopefully it doesn't drop out. But anyway, we'll talk about leading indicators. So I know in a lot of cases, ergonomic evaluations are, you know, always a good thing. And I know y'all mentioned that earlier as well, doing ergonomic evaluations as part of the onboarding process. So there's also, of course, work observations, there's inspections, there's near miss reporting. What are y'all's thoughts about leading indicators? Do y'all have any processes for that, measurement, KPIs, anything like that? Emmanuel, let's start with you this time. What do you think?
I think the you know, inspection and observations is very critical to ergonomics assessments and preventing ergonomic hazards, because you know, the work dynamics is always changing, and the employee that, you know, if you provide an ergonomic tool or you provide an ergonomic assessment device for an employee without you being able, if the employee is not using it the right way, it's still not going to be effective. So I think as you implement certain controls in place, you have to follow it up with continual evaluations and assessments to make sure that that is being used. And this is not in, so an example, this is not in my area, but then say in the hospital, we have, lifting devices for patients, but a lot of the time that may not get used mainly because it's either not around, in the room where that the patient needs to be lifted. And so, the employees go ahead and just lift that patient, or the patient might not be comfortable being lifted with that device. So I think that just following it up with observations and also just doing some type of participatory assessments to really kind of, if you find out the employees are not using those things or following the techniques that they've been trained on, just really getting to understand, the why they are not doing certain, following the training or lifting the way they need to be lifted or performing certain tactics the way it needs to be done safely, can help you really understand some of the barriers that is preventing them from doing it. And you can adjust those controls to make sure that it's still leading them to be safe, but then also something that they can do.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think those are really good points. And, some of the things that you already mentioned, Corey, we use on an ongoing basis, which is, the observations. And that's actually a quarterly requirement of all employees that we have some type of observation, either from the manager or from the EHS staff. And so having those observations also allows us to look at the data and see, what's being observed. Was there something that had to be corrected, or was there something shared by the employee that indicated that we may need to look at, how this job is done? And do we need to bring in equipment or additional PPE? So having those observations gives a lot of feedback and information for us to track and find out, if there are any leading indicators out there that we may be going down a path for eventual ergonomic hazards. And also just having, people knowing that if they're having any type of pain or something, that they're reporting those early, so we can catch them at the earlier stages as opposed to it becoming a chronic issue and now it's going to cost quite a bit for not only employee as far as time away from work, but also just the cost for the medical to actually address that and potentially, a long-term injury for the employee that they may have to live with. So, encouraging people to report those early so that we know that we can go in and help them hopefully recover from it and avoid any additional injury to them.
And I want to say that, continual assessments is really needed in every task. Also looking at the individual and looking at some of their personal characteristics in terms of heights, body weights, and just doing some type of assessments to and incorporating those into your evaluations would really kind of help to determine if that individual does more manual material handling tasks. It could really help you to determine, their lifting capacities. You can make some adjustments for that particular individual. Trying to set a standard, one limit that everybody should not be lifting at, 50 pounds could be detrimental to another employee that, may have certain kind of characteristics that they may not be able to link those with. So just kind of looking at certain different employees and looking at the individual tasks and getting them involved in your evaluations would also really help to take out some of those issues that may make certain kind of economic recommendation and controls not effective.
Yeah, really good point. That was good.
Yep. Yeah, that's awesome. Definitely fantastic input. So yeah, we can see there, you know, we're able to identify the hazards, able to determine the most effective controls. And as y'all stated, you know, you're able to get those controls not only implemented, but early in the job duties in the career, so that you can catch those things proactively, and then you're able to either work on design or adjustments or processes. And then of course, y'all have got some fantastic procedures there for evaluating and validating those controls, so you can check on them early and prevent as much as possible. And then ultimately that'll help from having those long-term chronic exposures that lead to those types of injuries, and also the acute strains and things of that nature. So that's fantastic. You've got a outstanding amount of information. We sure appreciate y'all sharing that with us. Before we wrap up today, I know y'all are very busy, and I know it's also almost the end of the workday on a Friday, so I don't want to tie you up too long, but is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap it up today?
Sure, I'll jump in first. You know, I'm just of the belief that, you know, you have to have a really good safety plan if you're going to minimize injuries and cost. And so that just goes with the ergonomic program. If you don't have a program, you know, that's where you lose the benefit of, you know, preventing those high cost and lost days with your employees, as well as, you know, employee trust and belief that you have, you know, what's their best interest at heart. And with so many companies that are now operating with really tight margins, which resulting in smaller staffs, it's almost imperative that we keep people working safely day in and day out. And so that means that the company, you know, really has to work to prevent injuries and lost time by implementing a good program that has, you know, what their risks are, there's assessment, they have really good controls in place, and that they're educating their personnel on, you know, best practices, so that everybody can be a part of the prevention of any of these types of injuries that happen through the ergonomic program. And so that's just really kind of what I wanted to add. And I also think that the onboarding is probably the best place to start with ergonomics, because if you instill it in them as they come in the door, then it becomes a company culture that everybody is involved in making sure that the ergonomic program is strong.
That's great.
Yeah, I agree. I think training is really important, and just getting those information to the employees as they come in will really kind of set the standard. And then also having a good and effective assessment process is really going to be very, very helpful, because just continually evaluating some different types of tasks that comes up, or the existing ones, and identifying, you know, weaknesses in some of those things, and finding ways to improve it, or even reduce the number of repetitions, the amount of force that gets applied, and setting different upward postures that may affect that, and that can result in more injuries. And finding ways to eliminate those can really go a long way to reduce that. I know there are a lot of soft, you know, evaluation tools out there, and one of the evaluation tools is called Duet. It's a distal upper extremity tool that really kind of helps. You know, it's really not, it's not for the ergonomics. Anybody can use it. You don't have to be a professional ergonomist to do those kind of assessments, but it helps you really kind of estimate the number of repetitions and the number of force that is applied. And you do that for each and every task, and it gives that individual the daily dose of exposure. And so having that kind of estimate can, as a manager, or as, you know, as a supervisor, can help you to determine, you know, what adjustments needs to be done. If that individual is daily dose exposure is maybe on the extreme, you can make some modifications to make sure that the person is on the lower or medium level. So they are not really kind of pushing themselves to the point where they may have some kind of injury. So that's something I would recommend for any safety professional out there to look into. It's called Duets, and try to use some of those in their evaluations. In addition to the NIOSH lifting guidelines and all the other assessment tools that are out there.
That's fantastic. Yeah, that's great. I like how y'all are able to put all those layers of controls in place and then also implement that in a way that creates reliability and validity. And then it pushes toward that, to that culture change that you need, so that the expectation is to do things as safely as it can be, you know, within the operation. So that's great. Sure, appreciate y'all's input today. So yeah, we'll go ahead and we'll wrap it up today. And I don't want to hold up y'all's weekend, but for everybody listening, if you haven't seen it yet, definitely please check out what's going on with AOHP and ASSP both. In the case of ASSP, we got webinars coming up for both the healthcare practice specialty, where we have one coming up about diversity, equity, and inclusion on March 11th. And then we're going to have one coming up on April 4th about mindfulness and wellness. So definitely check that out. And then also we have our podcasts, which are up on anchor.fm/ASSP-HCPS-HealthBeat. And those are also available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So you can just type in ASSP HealthBeat and it'll come right up. We have 31 episodes and all fantastic speakers like today. Also with ASSP, of course, check out BICE, the Blacks in Safety Excellence, which Emmanuel and Stephanie are leaders in. They do a fantastic amount of work and a lot of great resources and presentations, publications, all kinds of stuff. And they're also going to be with us for the webinar on March 11th about diversity, equity, and inclusion. So we're looking forward to that. With AOHP, same, we have the AOHP podcast, which today's is a joint presentation. So AOHP is at anchor.fm/AOHP. And there's also about 28 episodes up there now, and also a lot of great webinars coming up. So there's going to be one coming up in March, which is about culture change. So we hope we can see you. And if there's anything you'd like to see, please feel free to reach out and let us know. You can find us on social media, LinkedIn and Twitter, or you can find us for ASSP on the ASSP communities and AOHP at AOHP.org. So with all that being said, we're going to wrap it up, but we hope to see you soon and we'll talk to you later.
Thank you.
Thank you.